Now, Congress passed the Federal CARES Act in March, putting $2 trillion into the economy in an effort to recover from the economic damage of the COVID-19 pandemic. That move added significantly to our federal deficit, which had already been rising by an unusual amount during a generally positive economy. Members of both major political parties criticize the deficit, especially when the other party is in power. But our next guest says we need to rethink the role of deficits, and sometimes they're not big enough. Stephanie Kelton is a professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. She's the author of the book, The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Well, let's dive right into this idea, modern monetary theory. We see it thrown around sometimes in political discussions. Can you give us the Cliff's Notes version of what it is?
Sure. Well, it's basically helping us to kind of update our lens, if you like. Like, we need a new prescriptive lens because we are having too many political debates. Too much of the discourse is taking place as if we're still basically on a gold standard when the monetary system has undergone a significant change. It happened back in 1971 when President Nixon closed the gold window and the dollar became untethered, no longer tied to gold. And so we have today what's called a fiat currency, a floating exchange rate. And the basic idea is that this opens up a great deal of policy space, having a currency that is no longer tied to the gold standard, to gold. And that for the most part, too often we have debates where we ask questions like, you know, how are you going to pay for that when someone wants to expand an existing program or introduce a new spending program? We say, where are you going to find the money? Well, where are you going to find the money is very much, you know, hearkening back to the gold standard, as if somebody needs to go, you know, dig something out of the ground somewhere in order to come up with the money to pay for things. So we're just trying to help people get a better understanding of how the monetary system works and the options that are available under the system that we have, and, you know, why we fail to take full advantage of the monetary system to build a better economy for everybody.
Let's dive into the national deficit and the overall debt. Now, a lot of times, as I said, politicians of both parties don't like having big deficits. They don't like the growing debt. And there's the analogy, well, you couldn't run a household this way. You couldn't run a city or state or business this way. You'd go bankrupt. And you make the case actually in your first chapter that no, if you can issue your own currency, you're fundamentally different than that household or that business with their budget. Why is that?
Well, because, and you're exactly right. One of us is different from the others, and the federal government is fundamentally different from you and I, from a household, from a private business, or even from state and local governments. And the key distinction is that the federal government is the issuer of our currency, the U.S. dollar. They have the sole legal authority to issue the U.S. dollar. If I try to create the thing, you know, and I get caught, it's called counterfeiting, and it's against the law, and I'm going to end up in an orange jumpsuit. If governors could issue the currency, they would not be desperately pleading with Congress right now to help them. They are hemorrhaging tax revenue. They are in dire straits. They're laying off public sector workers. They can't continue to operate their budgets unless they get help from the federal government. Only the currency issuer can provide the funding to state and local governments to help prop up small businesses and larger corporations, entire industries like the cruise lines and the airlines, retail, restaurants, and so forth. It's the currency issuer who is different from everybody else.
There's a fundamental kind of mental mindset that I think you're looking to change for a lot of people. I think, again, harkening back to the gold standard, but even now, this idea that a dollar bill represents something, its value is based on something. And it seems like it's more of, in the modern monetary theory concept, I don't know, like a mental construct that we can use to keep score of our economy. Help me sort that out.
Well, it is that, and it is also a tax credit. And so you can think of the dollars that you have in your pocket. The government does not promise to, if you hand the government a $10 bill, they don't promise you some amount of gold. They don't promise to convert it into anything real at a fixed price. What they'll do is give you two fives or 10 ones. But what they'll also do is reduce your tax liability by $10. So the U.S. dollar is a tax credit, and the fundamental obligation of the government as the issuer of the currency is to accept that currency back in payment to itself. So all of us can use that currency to settle our tax obligations at the end of the year, April 15th or whenever that kind of moving deadline now happens to be. But, you know, the government uses the monetary system to get the rest of us to work and produce things for the state so that we can have some public goods, so that we can have, you know, highways, and so that we can have hospitals, and so that we can have an army, a national defense. There are a number of public goods that we collectively produce for the state in exchange for the state's currency, which is then useful to us in settling our obligations with the federal government.
Talking to Stephanie Kelton, economist and author of the new book, The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. Stephanie, if say, the United States government agreed with you, yes, we're going with this modern monetary theory, we're not going to base our spending and taxing decisions on our concerns over the deficit, what could that look like?
Well, just look at what Congress has been doing. Right? Since March, since the coronavirus took hold and Congress began to act, so far the House has passed 5 pieces of legislation. The Senate has gone along with 4 of those. And the largest you referred to just a little while ago when you talked about the CARES Act. That's the biggest piece of legislation that has gotten through both houses of Congress and signed into law. That's the CARES Act. That's $2.2 trillion. Okay, and so Congress is doing precisely what we've been talking about. They committed to spending money they quote unquote did not have. They didn't go out and raise taxes and collect a bunch of dollars from you and from me and from struggling businesses. They didn't go ask China if it would be okay if maybe they could help, lend us $2.2 trillion. Congress is the issuer, right? They have the power of the purse. The federal government is the issuer of the currency. It can commit to spending dollars it does not have, unlike state and local governments we talked about earlier. So the answer to your question is they're doing it now. And thank God that they have that power, because can you imagine what it would be like if we were on a gold standard and we didn't have a monetary system that was nimble enough to allow Congress to respond quickly and aggressively to an unfolding economic crisis like the one that we're currently fighting against.
And then a common objection would be, well, wait a minute, if they're spending money they don't have, don't they have to reckon with that sometime? Or isn't a bill going to come due?
Well, no, not really. What they're doing is they're making payments, and they're making payments in a currency, again, that they and only they can issue. Now, some of that currency, some of those dollars that find their way into people's hands as the government spends, get recycled, and they become U.S. treasuries. And, you know, we could have probably a long discussion about what that really looks like and what it entails. We refer to it as government borrowing. We say that those treasuries are part of the national debt. I think both of those descriptions are really unhelpful. I think they confuse people. They're not accurately describing what's actually taking place. Government isn't borrowing in the same way that you and I would borrow. If we charge up our credit card or we go to the bank and take out a loan, we're really on the hook. We've got to earn or somehow come up with the money ultimately to pay back those loans. The government is basically deciding to make some of its payments in the form of interest-bearing currency. And that's what U.S. government bonds are. They're dollars that pay interest. Congress chooses to do that. It wouldn't have to, but it's choosing to make some of its payments that way. Our problem is that we use a label to refer to all of those outstanding government bonds. We call it the national debt. And that word then creates a lot of anxiety, unnecessarily, I believe, in the American people. There's nothing inherently risky about what's taking place. What you would want to pay attention to is whether Congress is providing too much fiscal support. Too many dollars are falling into the hands of people, and some of those are interest-bearing dollars, and that could potentially lead to inflation. But I would argue that Congress is not doing too much at the moment. They're doing too little.
We're talking to Stephanie Kelton right now, professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. Her new book is called The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the ideas you've heard so far or about how modern monetary theory works? Do you think the government should be spending more money, especially right now with a risky economy because of coronavirus? Or do you think the government should focus on reducing the annual deficit? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Stephanie Kelton, professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. She's with us to talk about her new book. It's called The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the national deficit? What do you think about this idea that we should worry less about the deficit? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Stan is with us in De Pere. Stan, hi.
Yeah, hi. A question for your guest. What percentage of the federal budget currently is just to pay the interest on our debt? And what will that look like a year from now with, you know, decreased tax revenue and increased government spending? Because I'm a little worried that I have a lot of credit cards in my wallet. I can live really great for a couple of years if I max out them cards, but eventually the bill comes due. So that's what I'm worried about.
Stan, thanks for the call. Stephanie, the debt service payments that we're already making.
Yeah, it's a concern for many, many people. I'll say a couple of things. It is, well, currently something less than 3%. Is the current number in terms of the share of the total federal government budget. Now, there are, you know, projections out there, and these can get lawmakers very exercised because they can look at, you know, a report that says eventually we're going to be spending more on interest than we're spending on national defense or something. So they see this as, you know, they're looking at it like the federal government's budget is a household budget. So when they see the interest expense piece rising, they think it's kind of like your cable bill. You know, if you have a fixed amount that you can spend every month and all of your income is accounted for, it all goes somewhere, and one line item in your budget becomes more expensive, your rent goes up, your cable bill goes up, it crowds out other things, right? It means you have less money to spend on everything else. But the federal government's budget doesn't work that way. So that's the first point. Congress can always choose to spend more on education or infrastructure or anything else, even if one item in its budget is increasing, like interest, for example. The other point, and I think it's more important, is that a currency-issuing government like the United States never has to borrow its own currency from anyone. Okay, the borrowing piece is purely voluntary. It's something Congress chooses to do, but it's not imperative. Think about it. If you could issue the U.S. dollar, would you ever worry? Would you ever worry about needing to borrow it from anyone? Hey, the government doesn't have to do that first. Second, if it chooses to make U.S. treasuries available, government bonds, so that savers can have an interest-bearing way to hold on to their dollars, it can always choose the interest rate that it wants to compensate savers. So that's another piece of this. The third piece is that those interest payments are income. If you are fortunate enough to hold some of those government bonds, well, you know, congratulations, you're receiving a risk-free reward because government bonds are default risk-free, but they pay a reward in the form of interest income. So every year you're getting additional dollars layered on top of your initial investment. So there are a lot of different ways to think about that, but I think that most of the things that get people excited about the interest are really not cause for concern.
Just in our last couple minutes, I want to bring on one more caller. Charles is with us in Eau Claire. Charles, hi.
Hi there. I wanted to ask the guest if increasing the supply of money to the United States people changes the value of the dollar, and by doing that, is there advantages to that? Is there disadvantages?
Does it dilute the dollar in our last couple of minutes?
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, you can look at what the central bank, for example, what the Fed has been doing just since 2008 from the financial crisis. You know, they did all these rounds of something called quantitative easing, which people said characterized as printing money. And now the Fed is doing it again, right? Buying lots and lots of financial assets to help support corporations and businesses and financial markets. And but central banks around the world are doing this. So there isn't an inherent dilution of the value of the dollar. It doesn't pose an inherent risk in terms of inflation or anything like that. In fact, it turns out it's pretty hard to cause inflation. Central banks around the world have spent the last number of decades, in some cases, in the case of Japan, three decades, trying to push the inflation rate up to 2% and struggling to do it. We haven't been able to get inflation up to a robust 2% here in the U.S. Europe has been struggling. So inflation's a tricky phenomenon, and it isn't very easy, it turns out, to get inflation going.
Thanks a lot for that call, and we'll leave it there for now. Stephanie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me back.
That's Stephanie Kelton, professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University. She's the author of the book, The Deficit Myth, Modern Monetary Theory and the Birth of the People's Economy. And you could still keep sharing your thoughts on the ideas she shared here and on the U.S. deficit and debt in general over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.